Welcome to episode 16. I'm Stuart McCullough, I'm the CEO of VHAA. Starting with this week's industrial roundup and with community health in particular. With respect to allied health professionals, a number of members, seven in total so far, have received letters from VAPA requesting meetings for bargaining. We've written to VAPA on the 29th of March and proposing to meet and are awaiting a response to that correspondence. With respect to the HWU, we have received a revised log of claims. The previous log of claims was some 64 pages long. The new log of claims is 62 pages long but includes draft clauses. In effect, it reduces the number of items of claim from 193 down to about 43. With regards to social and community services and the ASU, we're still awaiting a response to our most recent telephone messages. And with respect to medical scientists, we're yet to receive a log of claims, but anticipate receiving a log of claims shortly. With regards to our acute health service members, the mental health agreement is before Commissioner Johns. We have received a request for further information, and that has been provided, and anticipate that that will be approved and operating shortly. Similarly, with regards to the Allied Health Professionals Agreement, we received requests for information. Those requests have been answered, and we are hopeful that that will be approved and operating shortly. With respect to medical scientists, members will have received a request from us to submit their NERRs. Those notices are an important part of the bargaining process, and we are asking for those to be provided so that we can ensure that they are compliant with the Fair Work Act. Members can also anticipate that we'll be making requests for the return of those NERRs with all future agreements, including those for doctors and for maintenance. With respect to doctors, we are continuing to meet on a weekly basis and are seeking that AMA provide to us their draft provisions so that we can review them. A reference group is currently operating and meeting on a fortnightly basis. The maintenance agreement is still a subject of negotiations, and those negotiations are continuing. Across the board, I should also say that with regards to the nurses agreement, that we are preparing some materials with regards to long service leave and how it pertains to casual RNs. We'll seek to discuss that with both the working group, the department, and then with the ANMF. We're also working on some family violence guidelines, and thank you to all those members who have provided their feedback with regards to those draft guidelines. We will look to finalise those before commencing discussions with the department, and then after the department with the relevant unions. That's all for this week's Industrial Roundup. Welcome to the VHAA Weekly Update, where we discuss a particular subject in depth. Joining me this week is Principal Workplace Relations Advisor and amateur pet rock enthusiast, Tim Nagle. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you, Stuart. Good to be here.
Tim, would you do the honours with regards to this week's subject box?
I will.
So for the benefit of those people who are listening rather than watching this particular broadcast, could you describe the object?
It's a pipe, a tobacco pipe.
And from that object, what would you think that this week's subject is?
Fire safety.
Tim, you couldn't be more wrong. It's for that reason that I've also prepared a second, less conventional clue that may assist you to get to this week's subject. On the way to work this morning, I put this together.
Which is... I don't know what that is.
Perhaps if I took this object and placed it closer to here.
Still not with you.
Tim, that's Benedict Cumberstitch, also better known for playing TV's Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes, of course, was famous as an investigator. Today we're talking about the disciplinary procedures contained within the agreements and the role of investigations. To begin our discussion, it's probably worth just touching base as to where those disciplinary procedures have come from and where they are now in terms of the new enterprise agreements.
So this is one of those common clauses that we've been talking about before, and they've been inserted to the preliminary section of the agreements that have been negotiated so far during this round.
So previously we had disciplinary procedures as part of a number of agreements, the nurses agreement, the mental health agreement and the medical scientists agreement had disciplinary procedures in largely consistent terms, and the Health and Allied Services and Allied Health Professionals had different provisions. But as you say, the new agreements have a largely consistent clause with the same underpinning principles.
That's right.
And just in terms of the key items that arise from this provision.
So in terms of what it covers is procedural fairness, the difference between performance and misconduct, and it has a number of definitions inserted to assist with that. It's also got the process to investigate misconduct, and also includes the difference between serious misconduct and misconduct.
Just starting with those issues from the top, in particular procedural fairness. Procedural fairness is a term that is commonly invoked as though it were some form of indemnity during the process of a disciplinary procedure.
Yeah, so procedure fairness, I mean, is really a basic principle that we use a lot in terms of the disciplinary process. And it really comes down to three key principles. The first one is the right to be heard, which makes sense. The second one is the right to an unbiased decision maker. And the final one is the right to have decisions based on evidence. So really it's the fundamental building blocks for a disciplinary process.
I think the one that comes up commonly for members is that issue of the right to an unbiased decision maker, and there is sometimes a contest as to whether a particular decision maker can be regarded as unbiased.
And usually it's around the manager. And look, the situation is that the manager usually is an unbiased decision maker. There are certain circumstances where that might not be the case. For instance, if there's bullying allegations or there's some other reason why they might not be unbiased, but in the general, they are an unbiased decision maker.
So if the manager is somehow entwined in the circumstances of the allegation, that might be a basis to say that it might be better to have someone else decide?
Yeah, that's right.
And what if it is that the manager was a witness to the conduct that is said to be the subject of the disciplinary procedure?
Well, it depends on what the issue is. I think if they're a witness to a basic fact that's uncontested, for instance, a particular course of conduct that the employee says did occur, then they would be an unbiased decision maker. Where that's a little bit greyer is where there may be some subjectiveness to it, or where it's not completely an agreed fact. And depending on the circumstances, you may use an external person to that initial manager-employee relationship.
It's worth emphasising that the disciplinary procedures are really a product of a circumstance where oftentimes performance management hasn't succeeded, and that process has already been attempted, at least in part. It's not the first port of call. But I guess what we're saying is that members should consider those fundamental principles of procedural fairness to guide them as they go through the process that's set out under that clause.
Yeah, that's right.
And in terms of the disciplinary procedure and its application, under what circumstances does that disciplinary procedure apply?
So it applies where the employer has concerns either about the conduct of an employee or alternatively a performance issue that may constitute misconduct.
So what's an example of a conduct issue?
So a conduct issue is, it may be throwing something across the room, for instance, or it may be arriving late to work consecutively.
And that second tier, which is with regards to performance, which may constitute misconduct.
So that's really your situations around significant performance issues that may create a safety concern, or negligence, or these sort of issues where the performance is such a gravity that it creates a potential for misconduct.
I think what's helpful in the clause is that it actually defines what that term means in the context of performance.
Yes, and that was one of the insertions in the last round to give some clarity to the process, was being able to include the definitions of conduct, misconduct, and also performance.
And it really goes to that issue that the person has been appropriately supported to meet the performance requirements but is still not meeting them.
Yeah, because, I mean, there is a lot of situations in clinical areas where a performance is not treated in accordance with the disciplinary process, and it's really treated in accordance with a clinical support process where the individual is supported to meet the clinical expectations of the role.
So getting to those key defined terms, which are found early on in the clause, and starting with performance in particular.
So performance is included in the clause, and it's defined as the manner in which the employee fulfills his or her job requirements. The level of performance is determined by an employee's knowledge, skills, qualifications, abilities, and the requirements of the role.
That's an interesting definition, that it's requiring a fairly fulsome consideration of the employee's training and circumstances to determine whether or not there is a performance issue.
That's right, because the performance, the expectations of performance will differ depending on those key elements. So an individual who is a graduate nurse, for instance, will perform differently to someone who is a clinical nurse specialist. And that will be a product of those different considerations. So it would be unfair to hold a graduate to the level, the performance expectation level of one of those senior nurses, for instance.
There's also a definition of conduct.
Yes. So conduct is defined as the manner in which the employee's behaviour impacts on their work.
And we were talking before about misconduct in the context of performance. It might be worth just outlining that definition, because I think it's crucial to reinforce the circumstances under which this disciplinary procedure clause might apply.
And the misconduct definition is quite large, but it is an employee's intentional or negligent failure to abide by or to adhere to the standards of conduct expected by the employer. A performance issue can be considered misconduct where, despite all reasonable practical interventions by the employer, the employee is unable to fulfil all or part of their job requirements to a satisfactory level.
So those are the key definitions. I think it's probably also worth putting that clause in context. Although a disciplinary procedure does not inevitably result in termination, sometimes termination of employment is a matter for consideration under those circumstances. But it's probably worth reminding people of the effect of the qualifying period.
Yeah, so as people know, Section 382 of the Act says that those people who are terminated during their qualifying period or the first 6 months of their employment don't have access to the unfair dismissal regime under the Act. They still do have access, though, to discrimination provisions, for instance, and also general protection provisions, but they're specifically excluded from the unfair dismissal provisions.
Just in terms of that, whilst they're excluded from the unfair dismissal provisions, a person who is still within their qualifying period is not excluded from the disciplinary clause.
No, that's right.
And it's important that people still apply that process even when considering terminating within the qualifying period.
And that also gives them protection from claims, discrimination claims, for instance, and also general protections claims.
Because the actual reason will be well established through the disciplinary process.
Exactly.
I think a common mistake that we have seen employers make from time to time is to believe that they can simply terminate during the qualifying period without even giving a reason. Mm. And under those circumstances, it leaves it open to the employee to speculate as to the true reason for their dismissal.
Well, and that's exactly right. There's nothing, there shouldn't be any surprises through that process. So there'd be nothing worse in getting to that 6 month or just prior to that 6 months and it being news to the employee that they're not meeting the performance standards of the unit.
So that brings us probably to the key part of the provision that would make Benedict Cumberstitch proud, and that is that we need to talk about the investigation process. I think it's worth emphasising that this clause quite deliberately breaks the process into two distinct parts.
Yeah, so it does have two distinct parts, the investigation process and the disciplinary process.
Just in terms of the reason for that, both those requirements were part of the of the clauses as they were under the last agreements. However, the distinction between the two processes was never clear.
And that was a real issue that was raised prior to this EBA round, is that there was some confusion about how those two different processes interacted. So really the investigation process is about finding out what happened. So it's focused on that, achieving that goal. And then once the employer understands what happened, the disciplinary process is the next step, assuming that it warrants that. And the disciplinary process is really about determining whether disciplinary action is required or warranted.
It's worth emphasising that during the life of the previous agreements, that disputes about this clause and how those two components interacted were overrepresented.
That's right. I think that disciplinary process is takes up a significant portion of disputes.
The other thing I was struck with is that when we did have some discussions with a range of unions about how they saw those two things interacting, there wasn't a consistency of understanding amongst the various stakeholders.
No, there were different divergent views about how that should occur.
So in dealing with the first part of that process, the investigation process, first of all, what are the key elements for an investigation process?
So the key elements are listed in the clause, but they are that ensuring that the reason for any interview is explained, and that's self-explanatory. Also providing the employee with any material which forms the basis of any concerns.
I think that's one that does give rise to concerns from time to time.
Yeah, and look, it makes sense. If you want people to contribute to a process, then you need to tell them what the process is and also why you're undertaking the process. And the basis of that, of any concerns, is the reason why it's being carried out. So it should be provided to the employee.
It may be appropriate under some circumstances to redact some information if it's not relevant.
Well, that's right. I mean, often these processes are focused on a particular context or finding out a particular answer. So, I mean, that's the focus of the investigation, is to determine what happened in that context. So redundant information can be removed.
One of the most common reasons that we hear as to a resistance to providing documents that form the basis of the allegation are that it could identify the person making that allegation.
Well, and I mean, the part of the process is to find out what happened, so it makes it difficult, it may make it difficult for individuals to contribute to that process if they're not sure what the context is in. So, you know, there are some circumstances where that confidentiality is absolutely essential, but I'd suggest that the majority of circumstances are that it should be included.
I think for me that if there is truth to an allegation, then redacting the name of the person making the allegation is unlikely to be effective because in most circumstances the person who's the subject of the allegation will know. But the other thing is that a person who does make an allegation in good faith is entitled to protection. And it is very difficult to enforce that protection if it is that the person who is the subject of the allegation can say that they don't know who made the allegation.
Yeah, that's right. And look, often an employer will include a provision in any letter arranging meetings or explaining processes about victimisation or inappropriate conduct towards the person making the allegation.
I think it's fair to say that can be put quite highly. If there is any attempt to victimise somebody for making an allegation in good faith, then that potentially of itself could be an allegation of serious misconduct.
It certainly could, and I think it needs to be put that highly. Part of these processes are about addressing issues in the workplace, so any conduct that hampers that or tries to create a disincentive for that to happen needs to be treated quite seriously.
So we've talked about the requirement to provide information or materials that are relevant or form the basis of the allegation. What are the other essential ingredients to a sound investigation?
Ensuring the employees provide a reasonable opportunity to answer any concerns, and also a reasonable time to respond. So, I mean, ideally people should be given advance notice of what they've been asked to respond to and given an opportunity to respond in that fashion. Also, the employee should have a right to a representative being present during those meetings or discussions. And finally, the employee should take reasonable steps to investigate any response from the employee.
So at the point that an investigation has concluded, really there are a couple of grounds on which to reach a conclusion. In some instances, particular events that form the basis of an allegation may not be in dispute, but there may be some associated circumstances which are relevant to how they came about or should be considered in mitigation. But an employer at the point of demonstrating that a particular action has occurred or an event has occurred, it has a range of options that they may seek to pursue. It is possible, for example, after an investigation that an employer reaches a conclusion that the key contributing factor to an event was a lack of appropriate systems or training.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, And also, not only that, they may need to go away and do some further investigation and then come back to the person who the allegation was made against. So I think really the key outcome is that they understand what happened, and also in considering that, they need to consider why it happened as well.
So taking into account that broader context, that is not simply proving or demonstrating what happened, but considering the circumstances, it's then a matter of turning the employer turning its mind to what an appropriate next step is. They're not obliged to go and undertake a disciplinary process even if the allegation is substantiated.
No, they're not. And really, that taking the stepping into the disciplinary process is only required if they think it's warranted. So it may be, as you said, there's some system issues or there's some other cause that created the situation being investigated. And it may be just by addressing that that the employee can satisfy themselves that the risk of it reoccurring has been diminished.
So in effect, this is the second part of the process is where a decision is made that it could warrant a disciplinary action and a further opportunity for the employee to address not the events themselves, but the action proposed by the employer.
That's right.
And in terms of that, again, the employee is entitled to have a representative?
So they're entitled to have a representative and also to be clear about the basis for the proposed disciplinary action against them.
So in deciding whether or not to take disciplinary action, what are the kind of considerations that an employer should be mindful of?
Well, firstly, whether there's a valid reason, which should be obvious, but it is worth turning their mind to make sure that that box is ticked.
It's worth emphasising that in the event that there is a dispute, or either in the context of a dispute of a disciplinary process or a termination, that the Commission would turn its mind to that issue of whether there's a valid reason.
Well, whether there's a valid reason is the first criterion in determining whether a termination is harsh, unjust or unreasonable. So it needs to be considered at this step to save any concerns later on in the process. The other elements that need to be considered is whether the employee knew or ought to have known that the conduct or performance was not to an acceptable standard. And finally, any explanation by the employee relating to conduct, including any matters raised in mitigation.
I think that's really a key issue in terms of considering matters that might be relevant in mitigation. That's really a requirement to ensure that a blinkered approach is avoided and all the circumstances are being considered before making a decision.
And again, that will be considered in terms if it did go to an unfair dismissal process with an external person looking at it, they'll look at those circumstances as well. So to be forewarned is to be forearmed, so it is worth the employee turning their mind to that during the disciplinary process.
So in terms of the potential outcomes that could arise from a disciplinary process?
So the employee has a range of options in terms of how they deal with the disciplinary matters or the outcomes of a disciplinary process. So that may include counselling. It may include a warning that is verbal but written, which has always confused me. But
I think just my preference is to refer to it as the first warning. Never saw much benefit in referring to a verbal warning that had to be recorded in writing.
That's right. So if the person has received a written warning in the previous 12 months, then it is open to the employer to give them a second warning.
Just in terms of that, I think one of the common queries that we get is whether it needs to be the same course of conduct.
Well, the common provision talks about a course of conduct, but of course what constitutes a course of conduct is probably what's open a bit more to interpretation. So it may be that it's not the exact conduct being repeated, but it is, so it may be misconduct or it may be something that, broadly speaking, is in the same course of conduct.
I think for me, if you had an issue with regards to a clinical issue and then the next issue was lateness, it would be harder to treat that as being a single course of conduct.
Yes, that's right.
But two different kinds of events may have in common the issue of how somebody interacts with other staff members.
Exactly.
So it doesn't need to be the precise same manifestation of that issue.
You don't have to be rude in the same way for it to be a course of conduct.
So a second warning might be issued if a first warning has been issued for the same course of conduct within 12 months.
Yes, and the next step is a final warning after that could be issued if there's the same course of conduct in the previous 18 months. And again, finally, if that course of conduct repeats, then it's open to the employer to terminate the employment with notice.
Now, under some agreements, but not all, there is also the option of a first and final warning, but in quite specific circumstances.
The first and final warning is really quite unique, and that's in circumstances where the employer is able to terminate the person for serious misconduct, but decides potentially because of the mitigation put forward from the employee not to do that. So this creates an alternative to a first warning in those circumstances, it being a final warning.
But just in terms of that, I think it needs to be emphasised that it is solely in those circumstances where the matter at issue is serious misconduct, that dismissal for serious misconduct is being contemplated and the employer is electing to take some other option to continue the employment, having regard for all the circumstances. But it's not open to employers in any circumstance?
No, so outside serious misconduct, it's not open to an employer to give a first and final warning.
And it's worth emphasising that, say, in the case of the Health and Allied Managers and Administrative Workers Agreement, that does not have a provision for a first and final. However, if those circumstances did arise, it would be open to an employer to issue a first warning and make the point that if further conduct of that nature arose, that it could be viewed as serious misconduct.
Yes, because, I mean, if that course of conduct did arise again, then the employer would be looking to stand on its own two feet in terms of justifying a dismissal, and that would be because it met the requirements of a serious misconduct definition.
So in terms of where an employer does make a decision, that outcome then must be communicated to the employee.
Yeah, so the outcome and the reasons must be provided in writing to the employee.
I think it's always worth employers bearing in mind that when they are writing those letters to consider who they're writing for. On the one hand, they're writing for the employee and to be as clear and direct as possible and to avoid sort of jargon wherever possible, but also writing it in a way that if a third party such as the Fair Work Commission is reading that correspondence, they can understand exactly why it is that the employer has taken the action that they've taken, that they can be satisfied that the employer has considered all the circumstances and has followed a fair process.
Well, that's right. I mean, the termination letter is if that's the circumstance. Less so the other letters, but the termination letter in particular is a key piece of evidence or justification if it is examined by a third party. So the clearer that letter, the better.
It's probably worth us emphasising as well that distinction between misconduct and serious misconduct.
So the Fair Work Act regulations is quite specific about what constitutes serious misconduct. It includes a definition of that. That definition is willful or deliberate behaviour by an employee that is inconsistent with the continuation of the contract of employment as one point. The second point is conduct that causes serious and imminent risk to the health and safety of a person or the reputation, viability, profitability of the employee's business, theft, fraud or assault, the employee being intoxicated at work, and employees need to be careful about that definition because often employers have a policy that deals with supporting people in those circumstances. And finally, the employee refusing to carry out a lawful and reasonable instruction that is consistent with the employee's contract of employment. And I think that's probably the most common issue, is about that failure to follow lawful and reasonable directions.
It's worth emphasising as well that that definition is derived not from simply the agreements, but it's derived from the Fair Work Act regulations.
Yeah, that's true.
So, Tim, where a dismissal occurs, we know that people, if they finish their qualifying period, can contest that through the unfair dismissal regime. But where warnings are issued or counselling given or action under the disciplinary procedure, we know that that too can be contested through the dispute resolution procedures of our agreements. So with that in mind, what tips would you provide to members when they're going through a disciplinary process?
Well, I think the first step is to plan out the process. So referring back to the agreement and requirements, the clause is important. And also then following the steps, I think, is the key elements. And that includes ensuring that they give due consideration to all the elements that are listed in the clause.
That sounds like excellent advice. I'm sure Benedict Cumberbatch would agree. Thanks very much, Tim.
Thank you, Sean.
And thank you, Benedict.